I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the third episode of The Lives of Stonehenge, this short podcast series from the London Review of Books with me, Rosemary Hill. Over the four episodes, we're looking at what people have thought about Stonehenge for the past few hundred years, why it's come to matter so much in so many different ways in the story of this country. In the first two episodes, we were in the 17th and 18th centuries with the architects, Inigo Jones and John Wood, who were inspired by Stonehenge to transform British town planning, and with the antiquaries, John Aubrey, William Stukeley, who pioneered modern methods of archaeology as they tried to work out what Stonehenge is and why it's there. Well, today we're moving towards the 19th century and have to imagine ourselves again roaming across Salisbury Plain, this time with the eyes and the mind of a romantic, to see how, for the likes of Wordsworth, Blake, Turner and others, Stonehenge became a gloomy, menacing, richly psychological presence, a scene lit by intense personal and political drama against the background of the French Revolution and the Revolutionary Wars, crowded more than ever with mysterious and often violent druids. Joining me in this uncanny landscape, I'm delighted to say, is Seamus Perry, Professor of English at Oxford, who regular LRB podcast listeners will know well for his contributions with Mark Ford to the Close Reading series. Well, welcome, Seamus, and tell us, what was it that Stonehenge did to the romantic imagination?
Well, thank you. The way you've characterised the antiquarian writers of the 18th century, I suppose, summarises exactly the opposite of what the romantic poets and other writers saw in Stonehenge and in standing stone circles more generally. They're absolutely not interested in speculating in a historical way about the origins of these structures. They become important for Wordsworth and for Blake and for other people who we might touch on as incidents within the story of an individual consciousness, within individual subjective life. So there's a big switch, in a way, between the things you were talking about in your last podcast, which were attempts, however cranky they may seem now, to establish the objective truth about Stonehenge, a big shift away from that to Stonehenge becoming a subjective phenomenon within the life of an individual poet.
Yes, well, of course, the poets and the painters, we mustn't forget Turner and Constable came too, didn't have to worry so much about the facts. Constable went to a lecture on Stonehenge, where inevitably there were some theories, and he just came away and said, well, nobody knows, really. They didn't mind that. What they did mind, because we've now got to the end of the 18th century, where the picturesque has developed out of this sort of sense of views into, Nicholas Pevsner calls it psychoanalytic, a really developed philosophical theory of perception. So people are trying to relate their interior experience to their exterior experience, the qualities of light, the qualities of landscape, the sort of things that Stukeley was beginning to move towards are becoming part of, well, not exactly everyday experience, but part of the acknowledged experience. And I think, I don't know if you agree, but I think it's Wordsworth who really kind of brings all this to bear, first and last, and then looks a whole series of revisitings of Stonehenge.
Yes. I mean, I think the one historical or pseudo-historical fact that does linger and is important for these representations of Stonehenge is their association with druids and with ancient sacrifice and with a kind of primordial pre-Christian sort of religion which involves violence and death. And I think that's absolutely hanging in a kind of rather gothic way in the background of lots of the responses to Stonehenge made by Romantic period writers. And it's certainly there in Wordsworth's response. It's very important that the monument has that kind of penumbra of macabre association for Wordsworth's whole thought process to get going.
Yes, and they're not... I mean, there are these... Of course, all the images of the Druids are conflicting, and the poets feel free to pick and choose what they want. But Aylett Sams, who wrote one of the stupidest books ever on Stonehenge, which is completely wrong at every single point, but has the image of the Wicker Man, which we still haven't ever got out of our heads, that was important to Wordsworth. And also he's got the good priests and the bad priests' image of Druids, because the Druids by this stage can be almost anything. And they come to, I mean, I suppose you could say they first come together in poetry with Chatterton, the doomed teenage poet whose poems were both forgeries, because he was pretending they were medieval, but after their forgery was discovered, they were still a huge source, like Ossian, of imaginative inspiration. And the Druids were a bit the same. It had long ago ceased to matter whether they actually existed or not, or what they were.
There's also, isn't there, an important connection which arises for reasons that I don't fully understand between the Druids and the figure of the bard, the kind of the ancient inspired sort of prophetic poet figure who Thomas Gray writes about, and Ossian, the great sort of semi at least fake poems of Ossian by Macpherson, creating a picture of a kind of inspired bardic solitary that is something that Wordsworth and Blake especially are really, you know, attracted to.
Exactly. Well, he's sort of, I think that the joining figure is a man called Edward Williams, who became better known as Iolo Morganwych. Apologies to Welsh listeners for the pronunciation. But he reinvented him. He was very keen on this bardic, druidic tradition, which he mostly invented and first celebrated the solstice with a stone circle on Primrose Hill, actually. He was also, we must add, a really heavy and enthusiastic user of laudanum. So a lot of his ideas, if one can call them that, sprang basically from being very trippy. So by the time the Romantics arrive, you've got all these resources, poetic, psychedelic, and intellectual, to draw on. But Wordsworth's encounter on Salisbury Plain sort of starts with just in a very banal way with an accident.
Yes, that's right. So this is back in 1793, and Wordsworth and a friend of his go for a walking tour, as Romantic poets did, a long and arduous one in the West Country. Wordsworth's horse plays up in some way, and the carriage that they're riding in is smashed. Then quite what happened is lost to history, but his friend seems to have taken the good horse and rode off into the distance.
We've all been on trips with friends like that.
And left his friend Wordsworth to make his way across the entire length of Salisbury Plain to go back, I suppose, to Dorset. So that's the, as it were, the real life event that's happening. And in later on in the 1830s, Wordsworth remembers this incident in his life, and he describes it as a couple of days rambling about Salisbury Plain, which doesn't make it sound terribly traumatic or strenuous or scary. But actually, the poem he writes about this episode, which is initially called Salisbury Plain and then it's later called Adventures on Salisbury Plain, actually does portray this experience as being really kind of seismic and sublime and terrifying.
And also deeply, well, can you say it's allegorical, it's symbolic, the whole scene is laden with the significance of the background of the French Revolution, England, Britain at war with France, but also the whole of Europe, the beginnings of, you know, the nearest thing they'd been to a world war, and Wordsworth's own radical politics at this stage still?
Yes, I mean, we're talking about the Romantics responding to Stonehenge in an imaginative as opposed to a scholarly way, and of course that's true, but that doesn't mean that politics is absent at all from the mix. And certainly this period of Wordsworth's life, he's at his most intensely politicised, really. Unlike all the other English Romantic poets, Wordsworth has actually been in France. He's actually seen the Revolution as a human event, not just as something reported in the newspapers or discussed in the pamphlet wars that are raging in England. He's been there in 1790 on a walking tour where he kind of bumps into the Revolution by mistake, really. But then he goes back in 1791 and 2, and there his motive for going is that there is this extraordinary, historically unprecedented thing happening in France that he is deeply committed to, deeply involved with. He has a relationship with a woman in the pro-revolutionary side of France. He gets her pregnant. He's increasingly immersed in French life. He returns home in 1792 quite unwillingly. It's possible, just possible, this is the kind of thing that Wordsworth scholars have bitter arguments about in conferences, it's just possible he returned to France in 1793. And if he did, then he really was encountering the Revolution as it's taking its most, you know, desperate turns.
And also, by 1793, he's an enemy alien.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the war has been declared.
Absolutely, because war has been declared. It's just about possible still to be a moderate friend of liberty and still support the idea of France until 1793. But then in 1793, the king loses his head, war is declared, and there's a general sense that the Revolution has spun out of control. That the Revolution, in short, doesn't look like the 1688 Glorious Revolution anymore, which is what lots of Englishmen hoped that it would. It's looking more and more like the Revolution of the 1640s, where you cut people's heads off and you hand over the nation to a republic of zealous nutcases.
Yes, always a mistake. But also, of course, he's caught, almost literally, I suppose, at Stonehenge, between a rock and a hard place, because the British government has, in response to the threat of invasion, become increasingly oppressive. Habeas corpus is suspended. People are being arrested for sedition, and we'll come to William Blake later, who was arrested for sedition, which was a capital crime. And Wordsworth and his friends were at one point, I think they were, weren't they sort of picked up on suspicion of being possible spies?
Certainly Coleridge is kept, they keep a close eye on Coleridge, certainly, yes.
So he's trapped in this sense of almost a kind of claustrophobic sense of what is happening to society, because on the one, in France, it's being overthrown, it's being destroyed, there's all this violence and bloodshed, and in Britain, things are not much better, and the encounter on Salisbury Plain with the woman and the orphan child, which comes in various versions of the poem, is a plea for peace, really, for saying that, you know, whatever your political position, when it comes down to it, when you have a revolution, when you have a war, it's the weak and the poor who suffer.
Yes, so the human encounter in Wordsworth's poem is with a figure who he will go on to call the female vagrant. And she is a victim of the system. I mean, that is her role in the poem. She has her own voice. She tells her own story, and it's about a life that has been destroyed by war, by imperial war, but also by cruelty at home, by social injustice, by a nation that is simply heedless of the sick and the impoverished. And her tale, which forms the centrepiece of the poem, it's sort of bookended by Stonehenge, if you like, but the centrepiece of the poem is her tale, and it is meant to be exemplary. This is Wordsworth offering us, as it were, the voice of contemporary England.
So it's an extraordinary passage in the middle, but then, as you say, bookended by Stonehenge, with these lurid, dramatic, very visual images with fire, and as I say, he wants his druids both ways. He wants the Wicker Man, he wants the cruelty, the sacrifice, which this woman is an example of the way in which small people get crushed by great events. But also he has the wise priests with their rods. He has a vision of a more benign possibility. And I think, I don't know whether he has in mind, because by now everyone's, if they want to, absorbed all these theories about Stonehenge. And one of the theories about the name, that it came from hanging place because a medieval gallows is like a trilithon, whether he sees the guillotine in the trilithon. I mean, it's once you've had that thought, it's quite difficult to get rid of.
Yes, that's true. I think that becomes much more explicit maybe in Blake's treatment of the stones. But I think that sense of political violence is also behind Wordsworth's encounter. It's about verses 9 and 10 and 11 of the poem, where he stumbles by accident across an antique castle, as he puts it, spreading wide. And a voice comes to him. So it's an imaginary voice within his own mind. Oh, from that mountain pile, avert thy face, whate'er betide at this tremendous hour, to hell's most cursed sprites the baleful place belongs, upreared by their magic power. So, it's, as I say, it's an extremely gothic representation of these ancient stones.
And he hears the voice from under the ground, which immediately makes you think of Hamlet.
Yes, absolutely.
A
voice
Play.
Beyond the grave, absolutely. And what the voice from beyond the grave tells Wordsworth about is precisely that druidic, gruesome fantasy that you were alluding to. For oft at dead of night, when dreadful fire reveals that powerful circle's reddening stones, mid priests and spectres grim and idols dire, far heard the great flame utters human moans, then all is hushed. Again the desert groans, a dismal light its farthest bounds illumes, while warrior spectres of gigantic bones, forth issuing from a thousand rifted tombs, wheel on their fiery steeds amid the infernal glooms. It's good stuff, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Powerful stuff. And emotion not yet recollected in tranquillity, it would seem.
But no, raw emotion, absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely raw emotion. But it comes back in the prelude in a more... well, a more digested, a more reflected, calmer form. But he goes on reverting, I think, to that, whatever it was that happened to him, however much afterwards, and because by the time he goes back with his wife in the 1840s, he says what everybody says today, oh, well, of course, it's all been spoiled. You know, when I first went there, Stonehenge was really marvellous. And you could go in among the stones, people always say that. But I'm interested, actually, in what he's thinking about Stonehenge and its... what it represents of humanity and human nature by the time he's digested it a bit, by the time we're getting to the prelude. I mean, what's happening there?
Well, I think there is an important shift from the poem of the mid-1790s and to his account of this same episode when he writes his great autobiographical poem, The Prelude, later to be called The Prelude, which comes to its first sort of finalised form in about 1805. So it's about 10 years later. In the 1790s poem, there's a direct parallel made between the dreadful things that the Druids did at Stonehenge and contemporary English society. So the bit I read out a moment ago is, as it were, from the first of the bookends. And if you jump to the end of the poem, he portrays huge wickers paled with circling fire, no longer horrid shrieks and dying cries to ears of demon gods in peals aspire, to demon gods a human sacrifice. So we don't have that, but there's still people being sacrificed in our own terrible new, to use the word, terrors that he uses. So obviously a very laden word with contemporary French history going on. And then the very last glimpse we get of Stonehenge is in the very, very last lines of the poem, where Wordsworth is assuming in this verse the voice of radical reason, capital R reason. So he's beginning to sound like Tom Paine or Godwin or, you know, one of the leading rationalist, pro-revolutionary or at least revolutionary sympathetic writers of the day, and saying, you know, we want to eradicate error, we want to eradicate everything that is irrational and all these bad superstitions that keep us in hock. But, he says interestingly, once we've swept the earth of superstition's reign, there's one that we should keep, he says. He's at the very last line of the poem, save that eternal pile which frowns on Sarum's plain. So we've got to get rid of all the evidences of superstition, but let's hang on to Stonehenge. So that implies an interesting movement in his mind, that there may be something about superstition or certain versions of superstition which might have a kind of imaginative value or significance.
Yes, or simply a kind of monetary value, because he's come round to seeing it as the child of darkness, deep and unknown days. So it's, instead of it being this very busy, populated, rather kind of cinerama scene, it's recaptured what it has for most people still, that sense of an inward kind of mystery that you're not going to solve it, you're not going to find out, and to be reminded all the time that there are things you will never know. Useful.
Mystery, I think. Absolutely. Yes, I completely agree with you about that. And I think that's what he, when he comes back in the prelude to reimagine this experience that he's had, all these political, allegorical meanings are shed, and it becomes very much about a psychological episode precisely occupied with the sorts of things you've just been talking about, with a sense of mystery and the unknown. And, you know, the deeply enigmatic and the scary, absolutely. But the frightening and the terror of it is no longer being given a political function. It's just a marker, really, of the extraordinary capacity of the human mind to invent its own terms of experience.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And that really brings us, I think, to Blake, for whom Stonehenge is, well, even more complicated, as things are generally for Blake, and who, in his long poem Jerusalem, long illustrated poem written as he created those wonderful books of watercolours with all the poetry written in and around the illustrations. Stonehenge is this very complicated symbol of so much. And when we talked about how we were going to do this podcast, you very rashly said that you would explain it for us. So go ahead, I'm all ears.
Yes, well, so it is a long poem, and Blake toiled over it for a long, long time. And it's full of the kind of visionary kind of obscurity and oddity and sheer idiosyncrasy that characterises lots of Blake's stuff. In a way, what it is, it's a State of England poem. When, you know, later in the 19th century, someone like Dickens or Disraeli wants to write a State of England novel, they write a realist piece of fiction that actually portrays bad social conditions or various kinds of injustice or social ills of one kind or another. Well, Blake's mind doesn't work like that. Blake thinks in terms of his private mythology. That's always where he starts. So the Jerusalem is really, as I say, a vision of England. And England is called Albion in Blake's story, and Albion is at once a kind of a giant and also a god and also a metaphor for the people of England. And what Albion should be doing is becoming Jerusalem. There's a strong kind of, you know, dissenting Protestant kind of element in the poem that envisages the salvation of England as being the establishment of a new Jerusalem. And Blake's theology is very, very cranky and odd, but within the terms of his own mythological dramatis personae, what Albion has to try and do is throw over the doleful influence of a kind of bad god who is presiding over England in the late 18th century. And this god is called by Blake Urizen. And that's partly a pun on horizon, because a horizon is a line that kind of limits rather than lets things enjoy their full kind of imaginative liberty. And it's also a pun. It's also an accusatory pun. It's Blake saying, your reason. He's pointing his finger at the 18th century and saying, this is where your cult of capital R reason has got us, this bad god Urizen, who is keeping Albion tied down in a state of kind of repression and complete sort of creative sterility. And the figure who's going to help Albion realise its destiny in a New Jerusalem, throwing off Urizen and all the constraints and appalling rationalist delusions that Urizen instills in us all, is a figure called Los, L-O-S, soul backwards. And that's a kind of mythical version of Blake himself. He's a kind of a poet figure who struggles and wrestles with all the forces of Urizen and tyranny and suppression and repression of all kinds. And I should say, for readers, if they go through all 100 pages of this fairly impenetrable work, it's good news in the end. We do get to Jerusalem in the last pages, and, you know, Lost pulls it off, I'm pleased to say.
Yes, though also anyone who goes through it looking for the lines that we now call Jerusalem should be aware that that's in a poem called Milton.
Yeah, that's absolutely
that's
right.
Just another level of confusion. But for Blake, I mean, always with the Romantics, biography is useful and relevant. And for Blake, it came at a moment when his visions, because he'd had this period of visionary happy. He was very happy. I mean, some people get very upset if they start seeing things and hearing voices. But for Blake, this was wonderful. And he'd had a period of being cut off from his voices. They had returned. He'd also had this awful experience, though, of being arrested for sedition. So he, like Wordsworth, was in at a moment of crisis and excitement in his life. And Stonehenge, the rocky shore of giant Albion, looms really, doesn't it, in the poem. It's not really comforting. He has questions about the Druids. He wonders whether they were proto-Christians. He's obviously, you can tell, especially if you're coming at it from the direction we're coming at it through these podcasts, you can see what Blake has read. He's very up to speed. He knows his vision of Avebury has the sort of the serpent pattern in it that comes all from Stukeley. He's read everything. And then, of course, by the time it's been through Blake's mind and comes out the other side, it's really very different.
Yes. I mean, I think, like Wordsworth, he is quite keen on the political implications that you can draw from Stonehenge being a place of sacrifice, being a place where, you know, human lives are destroyed. And he certainly picks up on that. I mean, his politics are much more odd and cranky than Wordsworth's, because he thinks that all the kinds of social injustice and ruin that he sees in the streets of London are caused by an unjust government and a wretched foreign policy and all the wrong attitudes towards modern thought and all those sorts of things that Wordsworth might agree with. But for Blake, it's all absolutely caught up in this Urizen story. And, I mean, he's got one of the greatest conspiracy theories of all English literature. Everything is part of the anti-art, the anti-imagination conspiracy. And that's in its negative implication, that's what the stupendous building on the plain of Salisbury that he talks about in Plate 66. Of his poem, that's what it stands for. It's the work of Urizen. Mighty Urizen is the architect, he says, of Stonehenge.
Well, he's like Stukeley in that, and indeed like a lot of people right up to the present, who come to Stonehenge wanting a unified field theory. They want Stonehenge somehow to embody the complete key to the meaning of absolutely everything.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, one of the things I love about this poem, which I don't understand, but I love going through it, is his, as you say, he says, Jerusalem is in Oxford Street, very close to where we're sitting now.
Yes.
And he talks about the fields from Islington to Marybone to Primrose Hill, because he knows that that's where Morgan Rhig set up the first Gorset of Bards. And St. John's Wood were builded over with pillars of gold, and there Jerusalem's pillars stood. And all these antiquaries who've been trying to get Stonehenge measurements to fit with the Druidic cubit, which has involved a lot of literal bending and stretching. But obviously Blake, you know, doesn't matter to him about that. It is so. Her little ones ran on the fields, the Lamb of God among them seen, fair Jerusalem, his bride, among the little meadows green. It's one of the things I love about Blake, that he's very keen on little things, lambs, small streams. So the contrast between all of us, really, down here in our little world, and this mighty force. And of course, the person who's been behind every episode of this series so far, though never at the front, is Isaac Newton. And Newton, of course, comes back again powerfully as the enemy for Blake.
Absolutely. I mean, Newton is to science what John Locke is to philosophy. They are absolute embodiments of the Eurozenic mindset in Blake's mythology. And the idea that you'd go to Stonehenge and you'd measure it, or you'd try to, you know, enumerate it, or you'd put numbers on the different stones so you can map it, that's just the work of Eurozen. What an extraordinarily bad way of responding to Stonehenge, Blake would say. You're trying to turn it into what Newton has turned the universe into, which is a vast machine that you can describe by mathematics. Well, that's not what the universe is really all about. In Blake's view, the universe is about the infinity that is the imagination, and the whole state apparatus is designed to crush that by schools or by universities or by churches, I mean, or whatever it is. And Newton absolutely is at the heart of the anti-arts conspiracy. Very unfair to Newton, it should be said.
Well, Newton, as I say, he is just the force behind, as I say, every episode of this podcast so far. And I think Newton, who of course had his own very peculiar to us numerological theories, and so on, but Blake, by this date, Blake is simply using him as. And there is that amazing image, which rather ambivalently has been turned into sculpture by Paolozzi and now sits outside the British Library of Newton, the great measurer. Whereas, as you say, Blake, when he has those lines about mock on, Voltaire, Rousseau, mock on, mock on, it is all in vain. You throw the sand against the wind and the wind flows it back again. I'm misquoting. But his complete confidence in this vision is what I think carries you through the poem and past these extraordinary fiery images of the really menacing trilithons. Which, I mean, even in Blake's very beautiful watercolours, he makes it quite frightening.
Yes, there's a fantastic and deeply sort of mythologized fantastical version of a trilithon in one of the plates of Jerusalem, on plate 70, if people want to go and look it up online, where it's massively outsized, isn't it? And it's looming over these three extremely vulnerable little people who are underneath its shadow. And the analogy you made earlier on about stones and a kind of passing resemblance to a guillotine or to a scaffold or something like that is absolutely what Blake is drawing on in that image, isn't it? It's Stonehenge as a kind of overshadowing, kind of sort of fascistic building that looks as if it's all set out to crush the spirits of the people who are gathered beneath it.
Yes, I mean, in terms of architecture, it's brutalist.
It is,
rather than
exactly.
Picturesque by the time it gets to Blake. And yet somehow it is embedded in this lyrical vision. I mean, it's pointless to say that Blake's extraordinary, but it is just wonderful. Weaving together of so many strands. And he has the little lines about how Jerusalem is also in the pubs and it's in the bathing ponds on Hampstead Heath.
And he associates Stonehenge with all kinds of failings. So in awful pomp and gold, in all the precious unhewn stones of Eden, they built a stupendous building on the plain of Salisbury with chains of rocks round London Stone, of reasonings, of unhewn demonstrations in labyrinthine arches. And then later on in that same passage, Loss, who's the kind of the poet figure within the poem, witnesses a kind of appalling sacrifice of what's called here the Daughters of Albion, which is to say that the women of England, who are being destroyed by, as it were, the literal interpretation of this would be that they're being destroyed by the social conditions of contemporary Britain. But as it were, within Blake's mythical parallel universe, they're being sacrificed by hateful new versions of Druids at his own version of Stonehenge. The Daughters of Albion, clothed in garments of needlework, strip them off from their shoulders and bosoms. They lay aside their garments. They sit naked upon the stone of trial. The knife of flint passes over the howling victims. His blood gushes and stains the fair side of the fair daughters of Albion. So it's gruesome stuff.
Yes, absolutely. But thinking of women, which we haven't very much in this series so far, because there aren't very many, but another scene set at Stonehenge, much less well known than Wordsworth and Blake, but written by somebody who really knew about the revolution in France, comes in Fanny Burney's novel, The Wanderer, subtitled Female Difficulties, which really is putting it very mildly indeed. But Fanny Burney, who'd been in France, she'd married Monsieur D'Arblay, so she'd lived in France under Napoleon's regime. She had no sentimental ideas about what had happened, and came back to England when the war was still on and wrote this book, The Wanderer, in which she says at great length, more or less what Wordsworth says, that the revolution, the violence inherent in the revolution, the horrors that we've seen, don't think that they don't apply here. Don't think that you're any better. So needless to say, it was a terrible flop because nobody wanted to hear this in Britain in 1814. But she has this extraordinary scene where her heroine, Juliet, the wanderer, who is trying to escape from the clammy clutches of her guardian, supposedly her guardian, who's obviously very predatory, and they arrive at Stonehenge, as tourists by this stage were arriving, and it had become a thing that in order to have the surprise arrival at Stonehenge, not to see it from too far away, but to get the full picturesque and sublime effect, you would go with your carriage blinds down. And then as you arrived, the blinds would all be let up and everyone would go, aha! But of course, if you were in a carriage with somebody who felt rather uneasy about this, was an extremely uncomfortable experience. But Juliet at Stonehenge, I think, I don't know, you would know more than me, but I think it's the first really female scene, certainly written by a woman, and the first time that the stones, she experiences them in a kind of motherly way. They are comforting to her, and that sense of deep, deep time just embraces her.
Yes, that's interesting, because we should say that more positive, let's say, or that more sympathetic kind of representation of the stones is actually something that you can glimpse in Blake just about, isn't it? So we've talked about the rather monstrous kind of illustration that you get halfway through, but the very, very last page of the poem or of the text is just a picture of a kind of heroic version of Lost, the poet figure. His work done, as it were, he's triumphant, Jerusalem has been established. But interestingly, in the background of that picture, you can see Blake has drawn a kind of idealized version of a complete Stonehenge. So, as it were, the ruin of the stone of Stonehenge and all its brutality is visually, I mean, he doesn't refer to it in the text, but is visually kind of restored and redeemed. And that more kind of redemptive, kind of health-giving Stonehenge, I guess, is in tune, isn't it, with what you were saying about Burney's experience there?
Yes, the consolations of time and indeed the lessons of time, which can be benign. It's not, I mean, it's really, yes, you're saying Blake is doing what Wordsworth does at the end, or later on in his explorations of Stonehenge, the kind of, the horror wears off, and what remains is this extraordinary witness to human experience over centuries and millennia.
Yes, and human invention, I think. I mean, that's part of what Blake is admiring in it, I think. It's just this extraordinary capacity to create.
And which takes us all the way back to Inigo Jones and how did they move those great big rocks,
yes,
which is a question that one still wonders about at Stonehenge. And I think the poems are all very visual, but we shouldn't forget that there were quite a lot of people painting and drawing Stonehenge, and the way that it's always depicted in Romantic art, it changes a lot with the Victorians, but in Romantic art, you never get a sort of a nice day at Stonehenge. It's always, there's always an electric storm or terrible clouds or some very, very dramatic weather feature. And it's also, of course, the poets aren't bothered about measurements. The artists really don't care. They just move everything round to where it looks best, as artists should do. But I mean, Turner's been hugely criticised by archaeologists, who it seems to me are slightly missing the point of what Turner was doing at Stonehenge.
Yes, absolutely. It's an extraordinary image, isn't it? And if people don't know what Ruskin, Turner's great champion, says about it in his book Modern Painters, I would, you know, recommend again getting online and looking up the passage. He says that the Stonehenge is perhaps the standard of storm drawing. He don't, you know, as it were, the absolute benchmark from now on about how you represent a storm in visual terms. And it is an extraordinary infernal kind of scene, isn't it? The overwhelming power, says Ruskin, the gigantic proportions and spaces of its cloud forms, the tremendous qualities of lurid and sulphurous colours which are gained in them. It's a vision of kind of chaos, isn't it, really?
Well, chaos and danger.
Yeah.
Because the shepherd is dead.
Yeah.
And also, because one has to remember that Turner was doing a watercolour as a preparatory stage to an engraving, which to us is probably much less interesting, the engraving. But the watercolour is astonishing. And it dramatises, really, the many thousand words of Wordsworth, the sort of the coincidence of subjective and objective experience, the world, the external world of nature and the elements, the creation of humankind and what happens when they come into collision, this cataclysmic experience, which can kill you, but is also what makes experience valuable.
And very different, you would say, I think, to the Constable, the famous Constable image.
Yes. Well, as I say, Constable, who was friends with various antiquaries and probably well acquainted with all the arguments and things, but wasn't really interested in that. I mean, the curious thing about Constable, really, in the context of everyone we've been talking about, is that he was very explicitly a Tory. He was a landowner. He was in no way a radical. He was very upset by a lot of the changes that were taking place in Britain. We've now moved on to the 1830s, the power of the church being limited, the power of land being limited. So he was quite perplexed by the future of civilization. And yet he gives, I mean, his Stonehenge watercolour was the biggest one he ever did. And he gives it this extraordinary double rainbow, which is the greatest, as he says, you know, it's the most kind of complex. It's the biggest thing the sky does. And he's put it there at Stonehenge.
How do you interpret that? Is it a symbol of hope? Is it like, you know, what Noah sees in the ark?
Well, I mean, the rainbow is traditionally a symbol of hope, and he puts it on the eve of the vote on the Great Reform Act. He was painting Salisbury Cathedral with a rainbow over it, the church under a stormy sky, but maybe it'll be all right, I suppose, would be a very banal way of describing the amazing effect of that painting. But I think, I mean, the interesting thing about that watercolour is that he worked on it for a long time. That's not so surprising. But that the last things he put into it were the rainbows and the hare in the grass. And these very fleeting things set in the context of this monumentality. I think Constable is thinking of, he's thinking about time, the passage of time, that all of this too will pass. So I don't know whether it's about hope or whether it's more just to say, remember your place in time. Well, of course, in a way, perhaps the death of Romanticism at Stonehenge comes with another death. And as we've been saying, I mean, on the whole, women at Stonehenge, with the exception of Fanny Burney's Wanderer, who finds it comforting, nothing very good happens to women at Stonehenge. And the worst fate of all is the fate that overtakes Thomas Hardy's Tess.
Yes, so this is the other end of the century now, 1891, the novel is published, and it has a wonderful scene almost at the very end of the novel where Tess and Angel Clare are wandering. Tess is guilty of a murder, and she knows that she doesn't have much time free. The police are in pursuit, and she's embracing her doom with a tremendous sort of placidity of spirit, really. And then entirely by chance, again, it's like Wordsworth, it's a chance encounter, they find themselves at Stonehenge. "It is Stonehenge," said Clare. Tess answers, "The heathen temple, you mean? Yes, older than the centuries, older than the d'Urbervilles. Well, what shall we do, darling? We may find shelter further on." But Tess, really tired by this time, flung herself upon an oblong slab that lay close at hand and was sheltered from the wind by a pillar. She can't go any further. She's too exhausted. He, teasingly, had called her a heathen when he first came to know her. So there's a kind of strange sort of fitting quality for this to be the scene of her last kind of time with him. And I suppose what Hardy's point is a little bit like Blake's point in Jerusalem. That is to say, this is a place where women are sacrificed because it is an emblem for a wider England, where women like Tess are sacrificed, I suppose we might say now, on the altar of patriarchy.
Hardy also does a very clever thing, because he's got this problem. It's very difficult to just sort of find suddenly that you're in Stonehenge.
Yes.
I mean, you can. This was the problem for the tour guides in the 18th century. But he has a very heavy mist on Salisbury Plain. And so the extraordinary thing is that they hear the stones,
yes,
before they see them. And it is a real meteorological phenomenon. You can sometimes hear the wind among the stones. So that is the most brilliant scenic effect. And then she sleeps on the stones. And again, very dramatically, the police arrive and Angel Clare tells them to wait until she wakes up. And I have to say, as someone who finds Hardy a sadistic writer at that point, I just think you really didn't need to do that to us. That really is too much. I mean, it's the most appalling and bitter end. And also in Hardy's mind, I think it is the death of a kind of romanticism, because yes, she represents women in general, but the d'Urbervilles are the last of this declining line, and Hardy's horror at what Darwin has uncovered about what it means to be human, that species come and species go. This wasn't something that worried Darwin, who came to Stonehenge to and used it to illustrate his own theory about earthworms. But to Hardy, who felt that what it meant was that it was a godless universe in which human understanding had evolved to a point where human physical existence could never be anything other than tragic. So that is all left with the, in my case, horrified reader at Stonehenge. The Victorians, of course, we've talked about the antiquaries and we've talked about the artists. With the Victorians, they did a lot of much more sensible, they went for picnics rather than visions and nervous breakdowns. And they did a lot of very sensible measuring. Of course, they photographed it for the first time. And they were able to produce many, many more facts about Stonehenge, all of them to some extent contested still, but many more facts than any previous age had had. After that came another influx of theories, visions, and more or less lunatic theories. And next time, we'll be talking about those. Thank you, Seamus, not least for all that light you've cast on Blake. And our producer will not let me let you go without saying something about your close reading series with Mark Ford.
Yes, we're in the thick of our third series of close readings called The Long and Short, which is about long poems and short stories written from about 1850 to the present day. We've looked at writers like Whitman and James, Catherine Mansfield, and we have lots of really good things in the pipeline, D.H. Lawrence and James Joyce and lots of other fantastic writers. And people can sign up to listen to the entire series. And there is a link in the description to this episode.
And for those who want to know more about Stonehenge, my own book, Stonehenge, is available in paperback. It was the first book on the subject ever to be written by a woman. And there's a link to it in the description of this programme.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.